Hi, this is Jeff Shelton, one of your co-hosts for the Engineering Commons, and I just wanted to let you know at the beginning of this episode that we had some technical difficulties in the recording, and as a result of some problems on my end, quite a number of pops and clicks on my audio, and so we've had to do some filtering to get rid of that, and as a result, it does sound somewhat like I've recorded from the inside of a small bathroom. So wanted to apologize for that problem on our end. We'll try to get that fixed and make sure that our audio is of a higher quality in the future. Thanks for understanding and hope you enjoyed this episode of the Engineering Commons. So, Chris, how was your weekend?
My weekend was full of construction and plaster dust and cutting and swearing and trying to shove things into place.
Well, this isn't exactly your standard wheelhouse, is it? You're kind of more comfortable with the soldering iron.
That's true. Although I'm getting into the home repair thing. I mean, I've had a house a couple years now. And I was actually over at my parents' house helping them with stuff. And I was in town and I was like, oh, I'll bring my new Sawzall, which I've talked about, which is a reciprocating saw. And you can, you know, destroy anything with that thing. I mean, it's just, you could.
Yeah, it cuts through just about anything.
Yeah.
I had a basketball post in our front driveway, next to our front driveway we moved in.
Yeah.
And since I didn't want it, I decided to cut it down. And when I started cutting into it, I discovered the previous owner had filled it with concrete.
Oh, my.
So I had a 10-foot-high pole that had steel pole that had concrete in it, and a Sawzall cut through it.
Like butter.
Well, it wasn't like butter. It was a little tougher, but it did cut through it.
Like frozen butter.
Yeah, frozen butter, right.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I had a similar problem. I was cutting through wood. I'm like, oh, this is going to be easy. Right. And then it turned out that the wonderful high-quality builders of the 50s decided to use maple as the framing wood of my parents' house. Mm-hmm. So it was like cutting through basically steel in the first place. And it was fun, though. But the thing about it is, I mean, people out there, I think construction and, you know, working with your hands is pretty common to a lot of engineers, even electrical engineers like me.
Right.
And the thing that kind of struck me about it, though, is that I was working with my dad, and he had this really nice layout of, like, where he wanted to cut and everything like that. And we started doing that, but it just, eventually, it's like, we can't do this anymore. We just started cutting. I mean, we stopped measuring, and we just started going because sometimes you just gotta get it done. And that kind of seemed like what we want to talk about this week on the Engineering Commons.
We're going to talk about the compromise when you can't have all the things that you want.
Yeah. Like Mick Jagger says.
Right. So sometimes you just have to, like you said, you're trying to figure out exactly what the right size of the hole is, and sometimes you just don't know. There's not enough information. There's not enough feedback. There's not enough of whatever it is you need to calculate this thing from the outside to do an analytic determination. So you got to start. You start to figure out what you've got behind the wall.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good way to say it.
And hopefully you manage to avoid cutting into any electrical.
The power was off. Another important note that hopefully all engineers and non-engineers alike heed: when you're cutting into walls, turn off the power first, which we did.
Yes.
So
yeah.
That works
when you're redoing the wiring in the bathroom too. I was this past summer redid one of our upstairs baths and was convinced that I had everything turned off and grabbed across a couple of lines and had forgotten that I had turned something back on to run the fan to make sure it was running.
Yes.
You do that a couple times and you tend to remember that.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. The thing about cutting into the wall, right? That's kind of like what we talked about in the first episode, the jumping off point, right? Like sometimes when you gotta put the blade to the wall and just start cutting, right?
Right.
But that's not always just the first step. I mean, there are usually some analytic steps. I think the tough thing, at least for me coming out of school, which has been a couple of years now, is that they never really gave you that point when you jumped away from the simulations, right? When you stopped doing SPICE and you realized that, you know, there's a compromise there too, because you don't necessarily have all the inputs and there's not perfect information. You just have to try it out.
Absolutely. In school, it's very hard to grade a problem if the solution isn't exact. If any number of answers could be correct, it's hard for the professor or the TA or whoever's grading the assignment to determine who got the answer correct and who got it wrong. So they tend to give problem sets that have an exact answer. You know, yes, it's correct, or no, it's not. But that's not how the real world works. In many cases, there's a whole range of correct answers. This is difficult to grade, but in the real world, that's the case. And then you've got a lot of people that have judgments as to how right or how good a particular answer might be. Sort of gets back into the feedback stuff we talked about last time.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes your solutions will have duct tape on them. I mean, that's a common thread for engineers as well, right? But it's true. I mean, sometimes there are those workarounds. Sometimes there's the bodge wires and electronics. I mean, sometimes you have to run a wire because, you know, you forgot a connection on a PCB or something similar.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, sometimes it's not perfect.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, before we get into kind of talking about that and the art of compromise, maybe you could update the listeners on the website that we have and how we're doing trying to get our iTunes feed.
Yeah, that's right. So we now have a website. Hopefully you are listening through it right now or through the feed or somehow you found us. This is the Engineering Commons, which we announced last time. But we also have theengineeringcommons.com, which is our new home base. And Jeff has been putting up great show notes so far, and we've been posting in each episode. There's a, you know, an embedded player, so you can just go straight there and click. Although we do obviously suggest subscribing to find out the latest and make sure you don't miss an episode. The iTunes, a lot of people own these iPads and these iPhones. Apparently, have you heard of these, Jeff?
I have heard of them. Yeah. They're somewhat mysterious devices that they talk about on TV, but
yes. And we're still waiting on these iPeople, the Apple folk, to register our iTunes feed, which can then easily be desubscribed to. So that should be forthcoming. Maybe even by the time we post this episode, it might be there. So check on our website. We'll have a link to both the regular feed burner feed, which you can subscribe to, or the iTunes feed. Or if you're so inclined, you can just go straight to theengineeringcommons.com and click play, which is another easy way to do it. So,
fantastic. Well, so in the related to our discussion of compromise, we kind of started to get into this, and that is when we're in school, we're taught that there is an exact answer because all the problems we're given are set up with precise constraints and precise measurements. But when you get out in the engineering, you do engineering in the real world, it's not that nice. It's not that clean. It's not that precise.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole range of solutions that might be correct.
Right. And, you know, something that feeds into the engineering, you know, schooling side of things is that most problems are thought up with the answer in mind, right? When you're working on a real world problem, often you don't have any clue what the answer might be. You don't know where you're going to end up. So getting there, you know, you have to make some compromises and figure out, well, I could try this and this, but this time I can't necessarily do everything on this problem, right? So it's never a perfect case. Sometimes you just got to jump in and start cutting into the wall.
Right. It took me a long time to realize in my calculus studies that there was a reason that so many of the problems involve polynomials or trigonometric functions. And that's because those all the polynomials are continuous, they're smooth. Same thing with most of the trig functions. And so they're well tailored to the calculus type solutions. And it isn't that when you get out in the real world, it's not like every curve is a polynomial or a trig function. It's that when they're teaching you calculus, they want to teach you with problems that work well, and these are the functions that work well.
Right.
I was a bit shocked when I went out in the real world and not every curve was a perfect polynomial that, you know, was a 3x squared plus 4y cubed.
I'm surprised you even found curves at all. Usually you find just straight up squiggly lines, right?
Right.
I mean, yeah.
Right.
So we also wanted to round out this conversation, though, with not just the the realities of engineering, but also the realities of working on projects, right? I mean, sometimes you're going to want to work on more simulations and try every solution or try every iteration of something, and you just can't because either you have cost constraints or you have your boss breathing down your neck because of cost constraints or, you know, a million other reasons. And so that's when the real trade-offs and the compromise come in, I think. I don't know about you. I mean,
absolutely. But it's, as an engineer, it's often our desire for things to be perfect or to be right or to be exact that cause the frustration on the part of others. You know, it's managers going, Jeff just doesn't understand that we don't need it to be perfect. We just need it good enough. We just need it to work. We just need it to show. We just need it to ship.
Yeah.
And I don't want to extrapolate too much from my own experience. I'm only a data point of one, but I know it's very easy to get into a mode where you say, well, just with a little more time, I can make it better, or I can improve it.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's always some way to tweak it or tune it to make things better. And it's so hard to let go of that thing, to let someone else take it, because you know as soon as they do, you've lost control. As long as it's in your mind or on your sketch pad or in your computer, it's your baby. You get to control it. But as soon as you turn it over to somebody, they're going to mangle it. They're going to change it. They're going to do what they need to do. And you feel a sense of loss. You sort of have to let that project go away.
Mm-hmm. I call it my engineering brain. So oftentimes, you know, I'll be talking to my boss or a coworker, and I'll actually say that. I'll say, here's what I think the solution should be. You know, so maybe I'm designing a plastic enclosure or I'm working on a connector, you know, layout or a circuit. And I'll say, my engineering brain wants perfect symmetry in this connector. I want it to be able to flip and have any kind of orientation and have it work. That's my engineering brain.
Right.
But my realistic brain says, well, that's never going to work. That's one of my trade-offs personally, that I know that I'd love to sit there all day and figure out some very complex situation where I could, you know, run multiple wires to every point of the connector, and then no matter which way you plug in, that you're always going to be right. And, you know, that's obviously that's a whole other topic of user design, right? User-centric design, right? Where you know that the user will plug something in backwards eventually. But my engineering brain wants to optimize that, right? And I think a lot of our listeners probably feel the same way, because that's just how a lot of engineers' brains work, I think. Like you said, it's, you know, you have this problem, you want to make it perfect, and you just want to keep cranking until it's right. But often, there's that pesky schedule or that pesky budget or that pesky coworker or something, and they're always tapping you on the shoulder and saying, you don't get to be perfect this time.
Right. Sometimes you have to, you just have to say that the perfect is the enemy of the good.
That's right. Yeah, and because good enough is part of engineering, right? I mean, that's almost what changes or what defines us from the scientists, right? I mean, sometimes you just get it working. I mean, scientists are after truth, I think.
Right.
And engineers are after solutions that work in the present moment. Right. They're not always perfect. And that's not meant to characterize every scientist, of course, as well, because that's, again, a whole other topic unto itself. But when you're searching for a quick solution or even just a solution, you don't get to be perfect, and you don't get to necessarily seek truth and seek that perfect equation, right?
Yes, the job of the engineer is not to tweak the design of the bridge so that it is perfect in all aspects. It is to design the bridge so that it doesn't collapse during the life of its use.
Mm. Right. Unlike the Tacoma Narrows. I actually heard a podcast about that. I forget who it was. But they were talking about it, and it was actually, much like you said, where the guy let go of control of this bridge. He designed it perfectly. It had the right structure and everything. And they handed it over to a different engineer. And the second engineer tried to pretty it up a little bit, removed a bunch of structural support that was there. And then, if people don't know, that's the Tacoma Narrows Bridge is the one that you could see videos from back in the day where it wobbled back and forth, and eventually it collapsed. And no one was killed, only a dog was killed. But I'll have to look that up so we can include that in the show notes. But it was a very interesting piece on what actually allowed that to happen, and, you know, how did they get to that point where you know, an engineer allowed that to go through, and they actually built the bridge that was that unstable.
It's easy to understand when you look at all the constraints that go into a design and all the things, all the details that have to be covered. It's easy to understand how something like that could be missed. But that's, you know, that's one of the duties of the engineer, to try to cover all that. To the extent that we don't know everything, we don't know all the behaviors and materials and and systems, then there may not be something we can do about it if we're not aware. But if we know about it, then it's our duty to try to take care of that and make systems and products that are safe.
Yeah. I'm almost wondering if I disproved our own theory there with that bridge thing, because in that case, the it's almost like, well, there should have been the perfect, right? The perfect was not the enemy of the good. The good was the enemy of the perfect in that case, but not necessarily. I mean, that engineer had it all right, and then it was more of an interjection of a second party that shouldn't have interjected and redesigned his work.
Right. Well, that goes back to last week's episode about feedback and the need for constant communication. And obviously, yeah, something got dropped in the turnaround there.
Yeah, eventually the bridge got dropped. Hard.
Yeah. Right. So talking about one last sort of little story about the perfect, not the perfect being the enemy of the good, or maybe I want to say it, the optimal is sometimes not attainable.
Right.
And I had a friend who was a aero engineer at Purdue, and he tells me that this story really happened. I've teased him a few times that certainly this is just an apocryphal story, that it couldn't have possibly happened this way. But he says, no, this really did happen. So he's in this aero class, and the professor asks a question about how many blades this turbine section should have. And one of the students in the assembly hall raises his hand and says it is 76.4 blades. And the professor looks at him and says, are you sure that's correct? And the student says, yes, I double-checked my equations. And this was an A student. He was a guy who would know. So he had calculated the optimal solution, but it had not yet dawned on him that getting that 0.4 blade in there,
right,
was going to be a little bit difficult.
And then the real world comes and slaps him in the face like a fish, right?
That's right.
Oh, man.
So those things happen, and at that point, you have to settle for something less than perfect. You're going to have to settle for good enough. So let's talk a little bit about how one might know or recognize what's good enough.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this earlier, and what actually eventually drives that, and I kind of was reminded of the low-cost, high quality, or fast. Pick two.
Right.
And that's kind of what it usually comes down to, right? That's what people say about product design often. You know, you can have it fast, and you can have it low cost, but it's going to be a piece of crap. Or you could have high quality, and you can have low cost, but it's going to take forever. Or you can have high quality, and it can be, what was the last one? Oh, yeah. High quality and fast, but it's going to cost a lot of money. And I think, you know, that's, every time you look at it, that is the balancing formula right there. So the good enough comes from, well, what do you want to give up on? Oftentimes these days, I think, you know, budgetary pressures are the biggest thing. In a back and forth with a marketing group, you know, they say, well, we want feature A, and we can't live without feature A. And then usually you have to go off and you design feature A, and they say, oh, that's way too much money. And you say, okay, well, then we have to take another 3 months to develop this. And often it's a back and forth, and that's the compromise. You know, you have to actually do it. You have to cut into the wall, right? You have to start doing it to show your results. But the compromise is going to be, well, take it or leave it, or I got to go back and redo it. And sometimes that's the compromise. That's, you know, hopefully with good planning, that's not the compromise. But I've definitely seen that before, where it's you want it, you got to pay for it, or you want it, you got to wait for it, or you want it, you got to take this piece of crap I just designed. So,
and I think the key there is understanding your own emotions that I was talking about before, about, you know, it's your baby, it's your project, you don't want to let loose of it. But as soon as you expose it to the light of day, then it's out there with all its warts. Everybody can see the problems, and you expose yourself to that feedback, to that potential criticism. And that's sometimes is a hard thing to do.
And it all comes crashing down. That's the worst thing. Oh, man, that's the worst thing. when you find out you're wrong, and you're just really wrong. Oh, that's
right.
That's a whole other thing, right? I mean, that's not necessarily a compromise. That's just being wrong. But that's what you reminded me of with the getting it out there. Sometimes you're just wrong. And, you know.
Right. And it is that feeling that as long as it's inside, you can make it right. That's quite a jolt when you let go of it and you hope, you're sort of hoping everybody will say, yes, Jeffrey, that was beautifully done.
This is a testament to humanity and engineering.
Right.
Here's a bonus.
But they don't. They go,
no.
What were you thinking?
Right.
And that's kind of an emotional letdown. But our job as engineers is not to have this state of emotional euphoria all the time. It is to get things done, to solve problems, to make things happen.
Yeah. It's weird how people lament engineers not necessarily being like empathetic or emotional creatures. And yet,
right.
And yet there's situations where we need to be completely devoid of it. And that, like in that situation where you've pushed your creation out in the world, you've maybe even already made compromises, and you still have to be prepared that someone's going to go run over and throw it in the trash bin right after you hand it to them.
Yes.
That's pretty terrible.
It's a struggle the first few times. You make a good effort and you don't understand exactly why people aren't responding well to it.
Right.
But then you just look at all the writers who had what were eventually considered terrific novels that were turned down by every publisher in the world.
That's true.
Yeah. Before they got their work out there. So
that's true. So what I guess the question then is, I mean, what kind of compromises do you have to make in order to, you know, get it out there and hopefully not have it thrown in the trash bin, right? I mean, that's the ultimate. We're shooting for really high goals here, people. I mean, we're saying, you know, our work's not trashed, and we get it done.
Right. So in the area that we're sort of talking about the cost and the cost of too good, but along with that is knowing when to spend the money to get something done. There's also a sense of, well, I can do it. If you give me enough time, I can figure this out. I am an engineer. I can solve this problem. And sometimes there's not enough time for that. You're not an expert, or at least I'm not an expert in everything. You, Chris, may be.
I am not, surprisingly.
But sometimes you have to say, I'll spend the money to bring somebody in who's an expert to come take care of the servo system or design the base of this press or to design the die for this press, whatever it happens to be. Sometimes you have to admit, I can't do it all. I don't have time enough to do it all. And you have to turn it over and go ahead and spend the money.
I had that exact experience recently. I was working on, you know, I had this idea of this model in my head of what I wanted this product to look like. And I started 3D modeling it. I think I've talked about on here.
Right.
And started 3D modeling it. And I could add features. And it was great because I had complete control. And I could change this and model that and show it all to people and render it all nice and pretty. But I'm an electrical engineer. This is ridiculous. Why am I doing this? I mean, like, first, there's that, right? I could end up learning SolidWorks or learning Pro-E or whatever.
Yes.
But that's a huge trade-off because not only then am I doing what is ultimately not very good work. You know, I'd love to think it was, but it really wasn't. And there's the opportunity cost that I'm giving up of working on electronics like I was hired to do.
Right.
And so, you know, we hired a mechanical firm. That is the right decision. That wasn't even a trade-off. I mean, that was just I didn't have a choice in that one. But
did someone suggest to you that you needed to make this move? That you needed to outsource this job?
Oh, yeah. I was told straight up, it is done. You're done. It's time for you to stop doing this. And of course, like a good engineer, I didn't listen. I still had a couple more tweaks in my head that I wanted to really get in there. But yeah, there was that very definitive point of, okay, it's time for the professionals to take over. And it was. I mean, he was right. The person who told me this was very right. And since then, I've seen what the work the professionals have done, and it would have taken me years to do what they did. And that's assuming I could have done it at all. So no love lost on that one. But that was the trade-off. That was, and since then, I've been working on the electronics, surprisingly. who knew? Electrical engineer working on electronics. So there is that point, and we don't think for a second that for that fast turnaround, we didn't pay a lot for it. I mean, that was our trade-off there, but sometimes you have to.
Right, because the job of the company is to get the product out there, not to allow Chris to enjoy his 3D modeling.
Right, yes. My happiness, although I love to think that my company has it my best interests in heart, I know that ultimately profit is the motive of companies, so... Who knew?
That's amazing how it works that way.
Right. You'll know it when you get back out there, Jeff, with your academics and your you'll know that the service industry of college is yeah, I'm sure you're laughing in your head right now, right? College is a service industry. I don't think so.
Well, it's certainly the world of academia is certainly a different world than what I experienced out of my own running a consulting business.
Right.
It just seems to take forever to get, you know, you work on a paper for months trying to get the right wording and you send it out, you get the reviews come back and you change things because this reviewer thought you needed to adjust the way this paragraph set things up. And it just, whereas in industry, if I spent more than, you know, 15 minutes writing a paragraph, I was wasting time. And right. Here I seem to be able to spend days or weeks tweaking on a paragraph, trying to just get it, right. So it's definitely.
Imagine you getting a quote back from, you know, or a response back to a quote you send out, right? And being like, Jeff, this was beautifully written, but what the hell were you thinking? Just get it done, man. And I don't care how much money it takes.
Right.
Yeah. I could see that.
Well, although I will say it is important when you're sending out quotes. In fact, I'm going to segue back into the compromise bit just a second, but it is important to specify what you're doing. And so if I was sending out a quote, I did spend time trying to detail exactly what the deliverables were because it's so easy for creeping featureism to work its way into the system. Mm. You know, you promised to develop, in my case, it was designing a machine that would have features A, B, and C. And at the beginning, no one could see beyond A, B, and C. But once we got into the project, all of a sudden, we all realized that features D, E, and F would be great add-ons to what we had.
Yeah.
If you've not specified that what you're doing is going to deliver A, B, C, and nothing else, then people would come back a month or two later and go, oh, well, you gave us a quote on a machine, and obviously this machine should have A, B, C, and D, E, F.
Right. Yeah, that's, you know, I have a note in here about Pareto and the Pareto principle, and that's kind of, it's known colloquially as the 80-20 rule, right?
Right.
And in your case, ABC was likely, you know, you were designing for that 80% case, right? And DEF, you know, you could start creeping in those, you know, 5% of the users wanted, 10% of the users wanted, but oftentimes it takes even longer to design those first off, and like you said, you didn't even, you know, price that in, so then your time is not included in there, that additional time it takes to get all those 10%, 20% use cases implemented.
And sometimes addition of D or E or F, you could do it without completely, you know, restructuring the entire machine. Or somebody's designing something else, the system or whatever they're working on. Sometimes, though, the addition of one of those features means you've got to completely rip everything apart and start over. It takes a fundamentally different approach to make that happen. But no one wants to hear, oh, that's going to, you know, be additional time and money. So again, another reason to be, you know, clear about specifying what it is you're going to deliver.
See, now I would think, though, you're taking that time and writing that paragraph or that quote so well.
Yeah.
I don't think, a potential client would like that necessarily, because then they can't come back to you and say, oh, well, you were vague here, so you have to do it, right? They don't want you to do that as a as someone paying you, right? They want to get everything for free.
Right. They're not in it to make me rich.
Right. They want low cost, and they want it fast, and they want high quality. They want all three.
Exactly.
Which is always the struggle, right? I mean, that's always the struggle between anyone. Everyone is supplying someone else. So, you know, if you're supplying X corporation with a widget and, you know, they want it low cost, they want it fast, and they want it high quality, and you're going to have to go to them and say, well, you only get two. And because you're turning around, you're going to your suppliers and they're saying, well, you're only going to get two. So it's always that struggle back and forth and that compromise of, you know, between the entire supply chain that really ends up butting heads. And that's kind of the whole conflict of engineering. I mean, I guess we solved it, so we can just close up shop here, Jeff.
Excellent. I'm so glad
that the whole podcast. We're just done with the podcast. Sorry.
I'm so glad we can solve these problems for the engineering world at large.
In three podcasts. So yeah,
that's pretty good.
It was easy.
We're efficient.
Yeah, fast and high quality and low cost. We must not be high quality.
I think we've come to the heart of the matter.
Yeah, darn.
Well, so in my world as an
academic.
Well, before that, as a consultant, you know, I was writing quotes for potential clients, and so I had a definite way to convey specifications to my clients. I mean, they would typically come to me and say, sometimes they would have a spec, what the machine had to do, but sometimes they would just come with a problem and we would have to work out that spec together.
Yeah.
Because they were actually cutting me a contract to do the job. And I'm kind of curious, you're not in a position in your role, Chris, where you're actually writing contracts or specifications probably with your management or with the other divisions. Is there anything that you're able to do to sort of convey what you're signing up for as you get into projects?
You mean like shouting and saying, I can't do that?
Well, okay. That may be one way.
That is one way. I mean, and there is compromise on specifications. I think you're right about that because there's always that back and forth. My most recent example, I had quasi-loose specifications. And really, I think it depends where you are in the product life cycle, right? If you're on a brand new, never been done before, mm-hmm. no one has specifications. Or if they do, they're necessarily wrong, right? Because no one knows what's possible to that's been done before, right? I mean, if you're, say you're going to mine an asteroid like they just announced, right?
Yeah.
No one knows how you're going to go mine an asteroid, right? You can't write a spec for that today,
right?
Because they don't know all the problems involved. So in like the very new cases, you have a loose spec, and I think you can go back and say, I can't do that. You know, like we have to work together here.
Mm-hmm.
And other times I've worked in release products before, which I've written about on Engineer Blogs, which is one of my blogging sites. And I've done supporting projects where I'm working on old stuff, you know, supporting dying products. And in that case, the specification is very tight. I mean, it works like this today. It's got to work like this tomorrow. Do your magic. Make it keep going. You know, like that's a whole other thing where you don't have that room to compromise. And in that case, the compromise is on the cost or the time. You know, it's going to take me 2 years to finish this, and it's going to cost you $100,000. And, you know, too bad, because there's no room on the specifications, the quality side.
Yeah. Well, one of the nice things about having specifications is then you can talk about whether you've met the specifications as opposed to talking about features. Because a lot of times design reviews get into a listing of features. You know, I've got this button, I've got this display, I've got this feedback loop. And that's all well and good, but that allows everybody to argue about, is that the right feedback loop? Is that the right button? Is that the right display? As opposed to talking about, have you addressed the functions or the specifications that are laid out?
Right. Everybody likes a checklist, right? I mean, that is very easily to measure. I mean, you were talking about measurement in the beginning of the episode, right? But sometimes you just got to cut into the wall. I mean, right? And in that case, I mean, I went, going back to that wall example, right? I mean, my measurement was, the measurement of me was, did this medicine cabinet I was putting in, did it fit? And the answer was yes. Yeah, it did. I mean, that was the ultimate measurement. I mean, I could have said, well, you didn't install lights around it and yada, yada, yada. But in the end, the measurement was there. I needed to cut out a big square box. I pushed this medicine cabinet in and it fit. And that was ultimately the goal, and we achieved the goal. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but it was done.
It worked.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, you started to talk a little bit about having to adjust what you were doing for the state of the project that you're working on, that a conceptual project was a little different than a final project.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to sort of change what you were looking for, the kind of feedback you were looking for based on the stage of the project.
Oh, the life cycle of what you're working on. Right. So if it's a release product, there's different specifications and needs and feedback and trade-offs than there are if it's a brand new product. Have you had the similar kind of life cycle experience where you've worked on maybe one of your old machines or, you know, and how that compares to, you know, a brand new problem?
Not really. Most of the machines that I would send out, I didn't see again. I mean, sometimes I would have to come in to get things set up and debugged. Mm-hmm. But after a period of, you know, 6 months or so, usually I didn't see those machines anymore.
Mm.
They'd worked them into their maintenance routine, and so I didn't have to worry about it down the line. But a machine is kind of different in that it doesn't have quite the same life cycle as a product. You can't spend too much time testing a machine concept because you need it now. You need it in production. You need something to start making widgets. And so you don't go too far outside of the box when you're doing that. If you do, then that's a research project. It's really not a machine design project.
I see. So you're, and I guess you're only, you have a low volume.
Yeah, usually the volume is one.
Right. And so your ultimate measure is, does it do the intended effect versus does it satisfy the market needs and yada, yada, yada product design, right?
Right. Yeah. But I do think you're right in that if you're doing a conceptual type design, and when I was working for a medical device company, and I've worked for a couple, then when you're doing something, that was a little more a typical engineering cycle, and you had to, at the conceptual stage, usually for us, it was meter prototypes. You know, you had to crank out some sort of prototype so that the marketing types could hold on to it and look at it and say, yes, this looks like it's the right size or the right form.
Mm-hmm. Where, yeah, and you get that you traded off that fast feedback loop for probably the cost of however much those prototypes cost, right?
Yes.
And they ain't cheap.
No.
Prototypes are never cheap.
And then later on, you weren't so much worried about the form issue. Now you were suddenly worrying about all the mechanics inside or the electronics inside or whatever it is you had to do to make the meter work. Mm. At that point, you're more specification driven. In the early stages, it's sort of more, what do you think? How does it feel type thing. Later stages, you've ironed out some specifications and you say, hey, did we meet those? Mm. So one of the other things that we talked a little bit about, you know, we've got to worry about the cost. We worry about the specifications. We worry about the client response to what we've been doing. One of the other things that you have to compromise on and worry about is time. And we talked a little bit about it in the idea that you sometimes have to trade off the money for the time in order to get something done that has to happen. And I'll just note that time is a big issue in that companies tend to, if they really need something, they tend to have ways to come up with more money. They tend to find ways to come up with more manpower if the job needs it, but they cannot come up with more time. There's no way for them to do it.
Yeah.
And so as an engineer, if you're working with a group of others in the company, other departments, the one thing you don't want to have happen is to find yourself short on time. You need to be, if you think things aren't going to get done on time, you need to be letting people know, because you can't make that up out of thin air.
That's right. Yeah. And if you can, you've found a heck of a product. You should start selling it immediately.
But let us know so we can be investors before you do that.
Right. Of course.
So if you've taken care of that, you've taken care of some of the external things, the costs, the specifications, the client response, and the time, there's another area that engineers have to deal with, which is maybe it falls more into the realm of uncertainty than compromise. But we work in a messy world. Steel tends to rust, and amplifiers have noise, bearings have friction. So one of the things, going back to the whole school idea, is we're trained to think that everything has an exact solution. But once you get out in the real world, you discover quickly that it doesn't. So if I'm designing some sort of beam that I don't want to break or fail, then I choose a steel, and there's many steels or many alloys out there to choose from. But what I look up in the table, if I find a steel that, you know, has a yield strength of, say, 30,000 PSI or 30 KSI, then I can make calculations on that. But I have to understand that's a mean value. That's not the actual value of the steel that's going to show up in the shop that's going to be cut and put into my device. It's a mean value. Mm. And so we okay. Accommodate that by throwing in a safety factor a lot of times. You know, there'll be a safety factor of 1.5 or 2.5, or depending on how critical the solution or the situation is, maybe you have a safety factor of 10 or even more.
So what's the trade-off with that then?
Well, the trade-off is the idea that you have to be aware of that uncertainty. You can't say, well, the book said that the steel should be 30 KSI, and so I'm going to design it as though this steel is 30 KSI. You either have to throw in a safety factor, or you have to say, okay, it says it's 30 KSI, but I'm going to assume that I'm only going to get 20 KSI just to give myself a little room of margin, or you've got to test the material. When it comes in, you've actually got to make mechanical tests to see what you've actually got.
Right. And so in that case, you either pay for more material, right? So you pay for higher quality material. That would be the trade-off there would be cost or weight of your product or whatever that might amount to. Or in terms of the testing, it would be the time of the manufacturing of the product, because you need to have specific testing in place to make sure that you are meeting your quality standards and everything like that.
Right. So I guess it's not so much compromise as it is just dealing with uncertainty and being aware that whatever you're going to get, it's going to be kind of fuzzy in the real world. There's not going to be an exact solution. There's not going to be an exact number for what kind of load that particular beam can carry. I mean, if you test it, yes, then you know. But if short of testing, you won't know the exact mechanical properties of that steel that's got into your device.
Yeah. I think safety and even the bit of over-design that is inherent in safe and redundant designs is a whole other topic unto itself as well.
Right.
So I'm going to have to go back through and listen to all these episodes and think, oh, yeah, I said this there. And we need to do another episode about that, Jeff. I think perhaps we should call this the episode and you know, wait for the next time and maybe talk about safety then or whatever's next on the Engineering Commons. What do you say?
Well, that's fine. I'm sure we'll have lots of time to cover lots of topics.
All right. Well, as we said at the beginning of the podcast, you can subscribe on theengineeringcommons.com, which you might be on currently, or you can hopefully subscribe on iTunes soon. You can follow us on our Twitter account, which automatically updates at TEC_podcast. You can find Jeff at Sheltonier on Twitter and me at Chris_Gamel. And until then, until next time, you can find the Engineering Commons right where it always is.
See you then.